This is Crucial Tech, a podcast about technology that affects all of us in a format that allows you to consume it in the time it takes to go to and from the grocery store. I'm your host, Lou Covey, and I probably know more about it than you do. And if I don't, I know someone who does. But first... This episode of Crucial Tech is brought to you by Cyber Protection Magazine. We will attend the ITSA 360 conference in Germany this year as a publication of record, and we are actively seeking sponsors. Want to reach 20,000 people in just a few days? This would be the most cost-effective means. And if you want to know why, listen to today's podcast. Hi, folks. Welcome to Crucial Tech, and we're back with one of our favorite subjects, Ian Thornton Trump, the chief of security for Cyjax, which is a cybersecurity company. What would you call yourself, an MSSP or?
No, like more of a traditional threat intelligence company, okay. You know, a la Recorded Future, Digital Shadows, those type of people.
Yeah, So you're the guy that sees the stuff that's coming.
I tend to work on the strategic outlook stuff. So like the long-term threats to organizations and businesses. Yeah. But we've got a great team that does like the more tactical stuff. So I guess, you know, I'm looking at the over the horizon rather than what's going on right now in cybersecurity. And Lou, there's a little bit going on.
Yeah, and that's what I want to talk to you about, because there was this news story that popped up in Reuters last week that I contacted you about. The headline says, cybercrime set to threaten Canada's security and prosperity, according to a spy agency. Yeah. And, you know, what did Canada do to offend someone?
You know? Like, that's news, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's been there. The Chinese have had their way with Canada in the early stages of, you know, Nortel networks. There's a lot of stuff about how Chinese threat actors have really influenced Canadian politics and Canadian businesses, the stealing of intellectual property, which is nothing new. Like, I mean, this stuff goes back to, you know, 2010, 2015, you know, and to be fair to Canada, there are some excellent people doing an excellent job, okay, but there's not enough of them. Like, there's nowhere near the amount of trained law enforcement and intelligence operators to protect a nation of 35 million people. It's just, it's like a handful of people. It's like five guys.
Yeah, right? but in defense of that, you know, I was taking a look at the numbers, and the amount of money they're investing into cybersecurity is increasing faster than what we're doing here in the United States, and even what I can see in the EU.
As a percentage, okay? Yeah. And that's really, really important to understand. Now, it's also because we're playing catch-up ball. And it's hard to like really put the numbers into context, because if I pay nothing for 10 years, right? And then I put in $100 million, right? Everybody goes, ooh, it's $100 million. It's a big number. Yeah, but I've neglected it for 10 years, right? So this is now actual catch-up ball, right? Whereas America's been extraditing cyber criminals in other countries since, well, you know, since APT1, when Mandiant decided to invent this whole industry of cybersecurity that we're now living in, right?
Right. So Canada's got a ways to go, but why in particular is Canada being targeted? And this news article just didn't say China. They also said Russia is involved in North Korea.
You know?
And again, I'm going, okay, well, I understand there's a large Chinese population in Canada.
West coast of Canada. Absolutely.
Oh, and I'm going to take a little side here, folks. The reason I'm talking to Ian is that he was instrumental in developing the security posture policy for Canada before he decided to turn the dark side and become going into the marketing or the actual business world and make some money rather than being a government person.
Free. I mean, you know, the part of the policy was really formed in the early days. And let's go back to that in 2013, 2014. I was hanging out at a hacker space called Skull Space Winnipeg. I took a bunch of those amazing degenerate people and said, let's build something called the Canadian Cyber Defense Challenge. And with Karen Cable, who was just recognized as one of the top women in cybersecurity for all her work in the Canadian press and Canadian InfoSec press, along with many others, we built this thing, which started educating youth, getting youth engaged into becoming the next cybersecurity professionals. And I did that for 5 years. And once we got some attention after about 3 years, when security was now a thing, the government started throwing some money behind it. ICTC got involved, which is a great organization in Canada, trying to boost that information technology and cybersecurity agenda. So it was me and many others that were involved. But I think the most important thing is back then in the 2015 to let's say 2019 era, there was a recognition that we have infrastructure that is desirable by threat actors. We have intellectual property that is desirable by threat actors. And when we took a stand on the issue of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we have a huge Ukrainian diaspora. I mean, one of the first waves of settlers into the western part of Canada was displaced Ukrainian folks fleeing the Stalinistic, basically, we're going to starve you until you die policies. So, So one of the things that the Russians are not, I think, unaware of is there's a massive amount of wealthy, successful Ukrainian businesses that have been established for at least 80, maybe even more years since the turn of the century, that are funding the Ukrainian effort against Russia. So that's, you know, I don't have to tell you what the crystal ball would say about suddenly attracting Russian ire for that massive amount of the population that is incredibly sympathetic. Now, the political reasoning behind this is really interesting. So hear me out. You've got a massive population that is pro-Ukraine, anti-Russian. If you're the government in power, you know, where are the votes? Okay. So this is why Canada's, you know, dusting off the old Carl Gustavs that we had in war stores and a bunch of our other stuff. We're taking the Leopard 1s down from the war memorials to the Cold War and putting them into service on behalf of the Ukrainians. Canada's pulling all the stops out to support the Ukrainian effort as much as we can, a nation of 35 million people, which has chronically underfunded any sort of military whatsoever. Why? Because we're not, to be fair, and it's been argued, we're not really a country, Lou. That's the other thing. We're a giant resource base for the United States. And as long as we keep that south flowing, Lou, everything works out well for us. But depending on what president is in power, Canada's position with the United States could get incredibly awkward. And that's probably why the 10th Mountain Division is located so near the Canadian border. But I think, you know, in proximity to Ottawa. But, you know, I think the realities of being a Canadian today is understanding that there's this giant nation, which is arguably about 10 times the size. So 350 million plus in the United States, 35 million in Canada. Oddly enough, 35 million in Canada matches about the population of California. And so that geopolitical equation just is something where we can't really have, I would say, the level of world presence that our neighbor has, you know, next to us. And that's why Canada, I think, you know, honestly, on the investigator checklist for cybercrime, I think the first step is to determine whether or not there's an American victim of any of the nefarious wrongdoings. And it's bye, 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 here you go. Not to mention the United States is very generous in rewarding allies for any information leading to the arrest of a cybercrime suspect. So we understand it almost could be a revenue generating opportunity to find those nefarious Canadians committing crimes against the United States, only to be quickly extradited to the kind attentions of the DOJ.
Oh, okay. That gives me a incredible insight into the relationship between Canada and the United States. Wow. I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I love Canada. Every time I've gone there, I've had a lovely time, except for being on Air Canada flights. Which...
that are going through Toronto where they lose your luggage.
Well, no, they're just incredibly rude. You know what? When you, the image of Canadians is incredibly polite, nice people. But you get on an Air Canada flight and the flight crew there, God, they are awful to the passengers. Absolutely horrible.
This is, I think, deliberate. It's the same reason with God bless them, Canada Border Services. We put the meanest and nastiest Canadians out there in front of you to lower the bar for everybody else. So if you have a super negative experience with your first Canadian, the next Canadian is like the most lovely and beautiful person ever.
It's not working. Every time I've gone through immigration at Canada, the guys, they're really nice, you know. And there's something my wife commented on. Says, man, they have good looking men working immigration in Canada, because they're all tall, dark, athletic, and the women aren't bad either. But I mean, there was a story that today about two passengers on the Montreal to Vegas shuttle. And somebody had vomited on the seats, and they done a perfunctory cleanup, and they said, "Well, we can't sit in this. It smells like vomit." And they said, "Well, if you don't sit down, we're going to kick you off the plane and put you on the no-fly list." Whoa!
Let's go through your options again, shall we? Would you like the chicken, the pasta, or the no-fly list?
So, getting back to the subject, what is Canada moving in the right direction, or are they still screwed?
Yeah, it's interesting, because in particular segments, Canada is exceptional. So I'll give you some examples in terms of the RCMP's investigative capabilities. In terms of like starting to build capacity in, shall we say, provincial and municipal law enforcement, it's still a bit of a catch-up game, okay? But where we're doing really well is when we put a product out there and we share it with the Five Eyes or Europol or Interpol, it's a really quality product. It's, we want this guy, because the only problem with that, Lou, is I don't think Canada's extradited a single cyber criminal to face justice in Canada. Okay. Now, and this is deeply problematic, because if you're going to walk the walk, you need to talk the talk and you need to send a message to cyber criminals. Now, it's been fortunate that amongst the various Canadian victims of like fraud and cyber, cyber events and attacking businesses, there's managed to be at least some sort of tangential relationship to America. So it's a lot easier to give all the great information and evidence that you've compiled to an organization like the FBI. And then they swoop in with nearly, in comparison, an unlimited budget in comparison to the Canadian resources that are allocated to cybercrime and fraud. And they're able to scoop up these actors no matter where they were. Don't forget, though, Lou, and the true story, we took a firm stance against the Indian call centers that were impersonating our Canadian revenue organization, which is very similar to the IRS in the United States. We call them the CRA for the Canadian Revenue Agency. We took a firm stand. We sent a Mountie, one guy, to India, and worked with the Indian police and arrested like 50 people. Okay. Now, that's like the drop in the bucket, but it still meant something, right? Yeah. And I'm sure that poor RCMP officer that was involved in that is still looking to try and get his expenses paid for that trip. But but the Canadian approach has been one of sort of like a very much, we have incredibly limited resources. How do we leverage our partner relationships? How do we try and put out sort of this image of us protecting Canadians? And it's hard, Lou, because we have the same problem that the United Kingdom has with the transparency laws. Canadians are reluctant to call out bad behavior and to make the records of those trials public. okay, in the way that you go on to the PACER system, and once the sentencing has occurred or once the indictment has been laid, that's all public information that can be consumed readily, and you basically know that these are very bad guys, right? Mm-hmm. We tend to err on the side of the privacy of individuals in Canada and the UK and other countries, whereas America is like, yeah, these are jerks. And we've indicted them, and here's all the evidence against them. We can't wait to get them to trial. We need to be more, I think, forthcoming and more transparent about the level of effort that's going in. I've said this, you know, publicly about the UK's justice system. The Canadian justice system should follow suit. It's rare that you get the RCMP commenting on a cybercrime investigation or the Peel Police in Toronto when they arrested a criminal mastermind that was living in his mom's house in a suburb of Toronto and had racked up millions of dollars in ransomware money in Bitcoin. And fortunately, there was an American victim, so we extradited him. It was probably shut him down now.
Yeah, thinking all of this, you know, about the cooperation that Canada's given to the U.S., are you seeing similar cooperation from the U.S.?
We're seeing an overwhelming desire to help Canada out by identifying cyber criminals within the midst of Canada, handing that information over to the RCMP and regional policing units. This has happened in Quebec. This has happened in Ontario, and having them execute the arrest and the seizures. They have a lot of faith in the Canadian justice system to do things right and to have that chain of evidence that's so vital in a cybercrime prosecution. But they appreciate the kind of the heavy lifting on the let's kick in the doors and grab the guy piece. But then the first move that they really want is an extradition hearing for the individual. And then, you know, they fall into the DOJ system. But there's a lot of help and support and cross-border coordination, not just amongst Canadian law enforcement capacity, but the intelligence services, border security, and even health services dealing with medical fraud and things like that.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear, you know, and I think that's at the core of everything we do in cybersecurity is cooperation, because it's essentially, we're on our own. Cybersecurity industry is really big. They're spending a lot of money. They're making a lot of money buying these tools and things that work to a degree. Like, I'm working on a story now about the agreement between the Microsoft Digital Crime Unit and Fortra. They got themselves a court order in March and are actually going after servers that are hosting the cracked Cobalt Strike software from Microsoft.
Right.
And one of the things I asked the guy at Fortra is, okay, what can people do to find this stuff in their systems and, you know, be a little proactive about it? It's all very simple. Just go out and get a pen tester organization to go through and find the stuff. And I went, huh. And I was thinking to myself, well, Cobalt Strike is a pen testing tool.
Right. Yeah.
So it's already there. So I called up a bunch of the pen testers I know and said, would pen testing solve this problem? And they said, well, maybe. I mean, if the people that are using the cracked Cobalt Strike tool were really incompetent, it might be really easy to find their stuff. But if they've got any kind of competence at all, they've hidden their tracks because that stuff is sitting in memory, not in the system.
Sure.
And so we might be able to find something, but it's highly unlikely. And it just comes down to the best defense against people using these tools against you is just to be vigilant
and do your traffic analysis, because this is the network battleground right here, is that if you have any sort of communication going on with domains or IP addresses that don't make any sense, then that's your first step of your investigation. And it's tough work because there's so much noise out there, Lou.
Yeah.
Right. And you're looking for that needle in about, you know, 1,000 haystacks, right? Yeah. But again, it's like there's tools out there like Gray Noise, where you can take a bunch of your information from your logs about what's exfiltrating from your business, throw it into Gray Noise. They'll parse it. They'll look at where the bad IP addresses are, the ones with poor reputation. And I mean, once that occurs, and once you have the level of maturity in your organization to be able to do that type of thing from a threat hunting perspective, that's awesome, because it then makes sense. Because if you're a Canadian small business or medium-sized business, and a lot of your traffic is going to Zimbabwe, that probably doesn't make a lot of sense, unless you have some business explanation for why you might be communicating with Zimbabwe, right? So right. In a lot of cases, though, you're right about the hiding, because if I know that that person's in Amazon, I'm going to spin up an Amazon instance right next door to them, right? And use that instance to conduct my attack and to, you know, exfiltrate that information via Amazon to then another proxy and another proxy. And by the time it's done, you know, the Multigo chart looks like this amazing, you know, spaghetti mess. And it's really, really hard to figure out exactly what's going on and where that data is going to. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot of like obfuscation and a lot of like counter forensics going on with the bad guys. But again, like a tool that's hacked, that doesn't have the ability to have the licensing revoked from it so that the tool no longer works, right? That's another issue that, you know, is a supply chain issue. You know, we can build these amazing pieces of software, but if we neglect to be able to like revoke its certificates or revoke its license keys because it's being used in a criminal matter, then, you know, that was an architecture design problem with the build of that tool. But right now, no one's willing to sort of hold anyone accountable for that, right? The only difference between Mimcats and a criminal investigation is the fact that it was never advertised on a criminal forum for criminals, right? But it's a very powerful pen testing tool to give you all of the administrative credentials that on a box that is running. And so again, what it comes down to is, you know, did you advertise it in the criminal underground forums? Did you advertise it and sell it to criminals? Okay, chances are the only thing we'll be able to prove is wire fraud. And that's how you go to jail for a really long time, right? You know, so again, this is a great example of like, you know, access brokers and other parts of the cyber criminal world where there's enough distance between the victim and the perpetrators and the facilitators of that crime to make it really difficult to prosecute individuals that are one or two steps removed. And then there's, of course, well, now that we have all your money in Bitcoin, how do we legit filter it, spend it, and turn it into fiat currency, right? So there's that whole other layer of the money laundering piece that you know, and then maybe you might get charged with proceeds of crime, right? These investigations are incredibly difficult. And one thing Canada and the United States have excelled at, I think, is information sharing and identifying these type of networks that are being stood up. Because, you know, you were right about saying in the case of the Chinese population, some of the Russian immigrants that we have and other transnational cyber criminal activity, there is going to be contacts external to the nations, America, Canada, you know, New Zealand, Australia, and the UK, that we're very cognizant that there is, you know, a homegrown support network for this money laundering, money muling that takes place. And unraveling that, my friend, wow. I mean, the amount of resources and cooperation you need from banking and from credit card companies is just, you know, it's unfathomable.
Okay. I don't know whether to be encouraged or terribly scared. Maybe a combination of both.
I think it's encouragement. And a couple of really interesting points about this. Canada knows and Canadians know where they're at in terms of their relationship to the world stage and businesses. We know there's a deficit. That's why we're spending a whole bunch of money, okay? But I think more to the point is Canadian foreign policy gets more aggressive and condemns activities of North Korea and China. Don't forget, we incarcerated a senior member of the Chinese company Huawei on behalf of the Americans for a while. That didn't do us, that didn't give any graces to us. And the Chinese retaliated by putting two Canadians in jail and threatening, of course, you know, execution. That that certainly was not our finest moment when it came to foreign policy ever. Yeah. But I think, you know, the reality is we're kind of stumbling through this. We know that we're going to be attacked. I think no one is of the illusion that somehow, oh, the Canadians are really nice, we're just going to leave them alone. No, there's intellectual property there. There's economic gain to be had from cyber criminals on the par with, you know, the California as a state. And I think that is a realization. And I know that from my own contacts in Canadian law enforcement, there's a huge effort to start educating them about cyber, but not just sort of like how to do a cyber investigation for a child exploitation material, but how to do a more advanced investigation, who to call, who to talk to amongst a group of folks that are knowledgeable about the subject area. And then also educating the public, which is, I think, a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, and this is where I think policing is really moving from, and you know, we have these community police officers. Well, quite frankly, Lou, all police officers should be community police officers first, and then their job specialty second. Okay.
Yeah.
But the idea here is that a big part of that community is the online community. And if we can interdict youth, like the amazing programs they have in the UK and even in the United States, for youth that are at risk and that have done some cybercrime stuff, and we can bring them back from that brink, we can turn them into allies to defend the digital economy rather than continuing down that road of getting to adulthood and then being charged and basically sentenced to a long period of time in the prison system. We have to do better. And just because somebody, I think, transgresses once is not, you know, I think is an opportunity, right? Yeah. It's not a challenge. And I think that's where the mindset is going. Because if we, you know, if we try to protect everything, Lou, we protect nothing. You know,
yeah,
because you always got to have a Sun Tzu quote in any information security interview. That's kind of mandatory, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we, as usual, we have run out of time and actually gone over time. Ian, thank you for this. This is a great insight into what's going on elsewhere in the world, and I appreciate everything you've done for us here.
Always my pleasure, Lou. It's great to talk to you, and hopefully we will again soon.
Yep. And that's it for this week's issue of Crucial Tech. If you have any questions or concerns or suggestions, you can contact us at cyberprotectionmagazine.com. We do get back to people when they contact us. And if you've got any ideas, we'd like to hear that too. So, and don't forget, we are going to be at ITSA 365 in October. We are going to be the publication of record there, and we are going to be reaching out to the 20,000 some people that are attending that to get with the program in cybersecurity. Thanks for listening. This has been a Footwasher Media production.